Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday. This hour of the program, we're talking about Ukraine, Russia, the United States, and the European Union. You heard the news at the top of the hour that the Crimean Parliament has asked Moscow to allow the southern Ukrainian region to enter into the Russian Federation with the rights of a subject of the Russian Federation. Crimean citizens could give their views in a referendum coming up pretty soon on March 16. The interim prime minister of Ukraine, Yatsenyuk, said that the move had no legal grounds. European Union leaders are meeting in Brussels to discuss how to respond to Russia's troop deployment on Ukrainian soil. And the NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen said that this crisis is not just about Ukraine. The crisis has serious implications for the security and stability of the Euro-Atlantic area as a whole. We clearly, he said, face the gravest threat to European security since the end of the Cold War. This hour, we'll talk about all of these issues. We'll have two guests, one of them joining us by phone from Ukraine. Nikolai Petro is with us, a professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island. He's currently a Fulbright research scholar in Ukraine. Little did he know that all of this would develop while he was there. He has previously taught at the Monterey Institute of International Studies and the University of Pennsylvania. And during the collapse of the Soviet Union, he served as special assistant for policy in the U.S. Department of State. He's the author of many books and has written about Russia for all kinds of publications: the Asia Times, Boston Globe, Christian Science Monitor, New York Times, Harvard International Review, and the list goes on. He is joining us by phone from Odessa, Ukraine. And later in the hour, we will have another guest with us, a professor of political science who is Russian-born, and he is also a professor of international affairs from George Washington University. Professor Nikolai Petro, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. Tell me about where you are in Ukraine right now.
I'm in the third largest city, Odessa, and it is Ukraine's largest port on the Black Sea.
And what kinds of conversations are you hearing from people there? Is everybody talking about this political situation?
Yeah, I think it's very much on everyone's mind. No one is very happy with Russia's involvement. But there's also an unhappiness, perhaps, with the uncertainty in Kyiv as well. There's a sense that the transition of power there that removed President Yanukovych wasn't handled very well either.
Mm-hmm. How so? How was it not handled well?
Well, it left a legal uncertainty because the president was removed without following proper impeachment procedures, and he has now fled the country. He still claims to be president. And so the Crimean authorities, for example, say that their actions have legitimacy because they appealed to Yanukovych, the president, and he apparently said that he approved of the Russian actions that were taken in the region.
Mm-hmm. From what I've read, Putin doesn't seem to hold Yanukovych in very high regard, does he?
Well, that's an interpretation of maybe personalities, but he has said in that long interview that he gave a few days ago that he sees him as having no political future in Ukraine. So,
is there a concern in the part of Ukraine where you are now and in other parts of Ukraine that this could lead to a war?
It's certainly a possibility, although I would like to stress that the good news is that after 5 days of military confrontation, there have been no deaths, and the only shots fired have been fired in the air. So that's a hopeful sign.
Mm-hmm.
Although the news that we see, that I see on the news here, Ukrainian and Russian, they're offering very contradictory assessments of what's happening with the military situation on the Crimean Peninsula.
So it may be difficult to know what the truth is.
Yeah, the Ukrainian side is stressing, the Ukrainian television is stressing the successful defense of the positions that the Ukrainian military is still holding. The Russian side is stressing how many Ukrainian troops have essentially surrendered or are not willing to fight. So there is a real discrepancy there in the reporting.
Professor Petro, what about this news we received, which is pretty recent, the Crimean parliament asking Moscow to allow the southern Ukrainian region to enter into the Russian Federation? Two questions. Is Russia likely to say, okay, come on in? And second question is, have they been wanting to do this for some period of time?
Well, Crimea is in a unique position because I think it's the only region in Ukraine that has a majority Russian ethnic population. And there have been tensions with the central government for most of the period since Ukraine's independence was declared from the Soviet Union, which is why it has this unusual status of an autonomous republic. And right now, because of the transition, the sort of difficult transition that has power that has taken place in Kiev, there was a transition as well in the Crimean parliament, which gave them a new parliament and a new leadership. And this leadership has taken advantage of the situation to press the issue of Ukrainian autonomy. Now, the original formulation of the referendum was that it would be a return to the 1992 Crimean Constitution within the within Ukraine. But that was changed just today to a formulation that offers two options, the formulation of staying within Ukraine or of choosing to join the Russian Federation. One additional thing that I think also is interesting to note is that the speaker who made the announcement about the referendum said that if the referendum chose in favor, if the people chose in favor of staying with the Ukraine, the Crimean parliament would resign.
And what about the European response and America's response to that? What would be highly problematic for all of those countries if indeed Moscow said okay and the southern Ukrainian region became a part of Russia again?
Yeah, well, I think the main difficulty is that it's hard to see such a referendum as legitimate because it would be done on very short notice and without international observers and without the blessing of the government in Kiev. I personally think it would be wiser for the government in Crimea to delay the holding of any referendum until at least the end of the year. That way tempers could cool, international observers could be involved, and this would lend any referendum that they hold much greater credibility. Also, by the end of the year, we expect that there will be a new Ukrainian president elected on May 25th, as well as a new parliament. And there's certainly been talk about granting greater autonomy and self-government, I should say, not autonomy, but some greater self-government to Crimea and to the other predominantly Russian-speaking regions in Ukraine.
And that greater autonomy would mean what? What would the people in Crimea be looking for?
Self-government. Because right now their autonomy doesn't seem to, well, it apparently doesn't satisfy some people. So that is something not only that is being discussed in Crimea, but in many regions of the east and the south of Ukraine as well. Because the people in those regions who don't view the government transfer in Kiev as legitimate are saying, well, wait a second, we can't have the country run the way it was run centrally from Kiev. What we would prefer is not to separate from the country, but greater local rights, so self-government.
Mm-hmm. And what about the election? So your concern, I mean, this is really rapid. March 16th is next week, you know, the week after next. So it would be kind of hard to make sure that these were on the up and up?
Well, I forget what the population is. I think it's over 2 million. And how's it going to be organized? How's it going to be supervised? How's it going to be counted? All of these questions are not just logistical ones. They raise the questions about the legitimacy of the referendum. So I think it's the right way to proceed if a region wants to make the case for a greater autonomy, but it mustn't, I would suggest it shouldn't be rushed. Otherwise, its credibility is very questionable.
And what about this new interim? They'll have elections as well, government in Kiev. I would think that things must be somewhat in flux. You just had an overthrow of a government. You don't really have a new plan in place, do you?
Well, there is an interim government right now. Prime minister, cabinet ministries have been filled. And right now, their main task before the Crimean crisis was to obtain financial assistance that would allow the country to survive financially until the May 25th elections, because, as the prime minister has said, the country is bankrupt. So now, in addition to that, they have to think about combating this separatism, dealing with this separatism in Crimea. And the situation has been compounded by manifestations, protests in several regions in the east and south, which are saying also that, you know, we are not happy with the situation in Kiev, the messy transition in power, and our response to that is that we want greater local rights, greater local federalism, what they call federalism.
And what about the response by the European Union and also by the United States? Reports here are that some European countries are saying, let's try to mediate this. We do a lot of business with Russia. We don't want to upset the apple cart. We get a lot of, you know, energy from them, et cetera. The United States authorizing the president, executive order authorizing sanctions against individuals and entities responsible for activities, they say, undermining the democratic processes or institutions in the Ukraine. Does there need to be more of a united front here? Or do any of these actions make any difference?
One of the things that I think is obvious when you look at the map is where Russia is compared to where Ukraine is and where the United States and Europe are. And any way you slice it, it seems to me this area is in Russia's sphere of influence. The ties, the economic ties, the geographic ties, everything is right there at hand, whereas for the United States, no matter what it might want, Ukraine is very far away. And I think the instrument of leverage that the United States and Europe have on the situation in Ukraine are relatively weak compared to those that Russia has. And that might be part of the reason why the reaction of the West is more ambivalent than one would expect.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that we hear is that Vladimir Putin has this grand design to be an Asian powerhouse, and this is just part of his plan to get Crimea and then to get Ukraine and to make his influence much stronger. Is there something, is that true or is that not true? Do we know what he's doing?
There is clearly a Eurasian strategy, and the objective that he was elected to the presidency on. He has a series of 7 articles in his electoral campaign explaining, among other things, what his economic plan, what his foreign policy agenda was, and it is to establish this Eurasian Union. The model, ostensibly, for the Eurasian Union is the European Union, and the logistics of it, the legal framework, the economic aspirations are modeled on eventually that kind of association. Many observers, however, in the West feel that any sort of integration in that former Soviet territory is automatically a threat to Western interests.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you can look at that in a more benign fashion as an economic and integration based on, Putin would say, close cultural ties that these countries have always had, yeah, any kind of getting together. I think Hillary Clinton made the comment when she was still Secretary of State that she, in particular, regarded any sort of integrative movement among those countries as a reconstitution of the USSR and essentially, therefore, as a threat to the United States.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. We're talking this half hour of the program, the first part of the show, with Professor Nikolai Petro, who happens to be on sabbatical as a U.S. Fulbright research scholar in Ukraine. He's in Odessa right now, and during the collapse of the Soviet Union, served as special assistant for policy in the U.S. State Department. Lots of questions here. Take it where you will. It has become a very, very big story with lots of concerns that this could spark a war. It's been described as another Cold War, the tensions being greater between the United States and Russia than any time since the Cold War. We're looking at the actions that have taken place today, the European response, the U.S. response. Join us with your thoughts. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And if you want to send a tweet, you can do that as well. That's @KDunnShow. Later in the program, Evgeny Finkel will join us, assistant professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University. He was born in Russia, in the Soviet Union, actually, and raised in Israel. And he's a native speaker of Russian and is also fluent in Ukrainian. So he will be with us with his analysis as well. Lots of phone calls coming in. We'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, 800-486-8655. Michael in Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I'm really disturbed about the fact that how the president and the Congress and the media is talking about punishing Russia and how we're going to make Russia pay for whatever they're doing. And I really don't think it's any of our business. I'll tell you what, that's in Russia's backyard. I think the United States... It's kind of ludicrous. We just got done fighting one war over the last 10 years, and we're finishing up another war where we've been fighting on the other side of the planet in countries that we really shouldn't be in for the last 10 years and even more wars previous to that. And all of a sudden, we're going to tell somebody how they should behave. I think it's pretty silly. Talk about a Cold War. If there is going to be a Cold War, I think the United States is trying its best to get it started with their rhetoric and the saber rattling. I don't know what they're trying to do. We can't afford another war. We don't have the wherewithal to get involved in a war. And if they would just back off a little bit and just quit trying to stir up the pot, which I think is all based on politics. I saw John McCain the other day, and he was just livid with rage because now they're blaming Obama because he has a weak country that he's managed.
All right, let's get a response. Professor Petro.
I would just reiterate the point I made before, which is not so much that it's not our business, but rather that our instruments of leverage are not as effective as those of Russia are because of history and geography. So it's very hard to be effective even if we do come in swinging, because the entire situation is against the United States being all that effective, except in perhaps punishing Russia directly. But every action which we might take to downgrade our economic relations or our political relations or our military relations, of course, also affects us reciprocally. So, there's no action that can be taken in politics without a cost.
When the New York Times yesterday wrote an editorial and said this at the end, the U.S. and Europe must prepare contingency plans for any escalation of Russian aggression or for the unilateral annexation of Crimea. You've worked in government. Do you imagine that people are sitting around now figuring out what in the world the contingency plans might be and what legitimately should be on the table, do you think?
First of all, let me say that my views are my own and right. Not those of the Fulbright Program or the U.S. State Department. It was about 20 years since I've been in the State Department. But as memory serves, contingency plans are some of what people try to prepare. Although it's a little difficult to prepare something as sudden as, imagine there was a sudden coup in a country and then, a region decides to separate off and Russia gets involved.
So, right.
That's all rather fanciful to imagine. What can be done right now? There have been some good essays. I would recommend, for example, Henry Kissinger's essay this morning in the Washington Post, How the Ukraine Crisis Ends. He's had 4 points. There's a very good, some very good writings and ideas by Jack Matlock, whom I served under briefly, our last ambassador to the Soviet Union, first ambassador to Russia, on his website, Jack Matlock. And by Anatole Levin. I mean, people are coming up with the right idea, which is that two things need to occur. Russia and Ukraine need to sit down and talk about what sorts of things will satisfy both of them. And also there needs to be greater internal dialogue probably in the Ukraine itself between the central government and those regions which are displeased with the way things have turned out in the current transition. I think the good news for this type of negotiation is that, let's remember, the extraordinary troop maneuvers ended recently. Again, in 5 days, no shots have been fired. So there's been rather a remarkable transfer, peaceful so far, of authority, although it's not recognized by Kiev. Putin's interview also clarified Russia's requirements for rescinding his troop authorization. And they are essentially two. One is that people in the East and the South, Ukrainian citizens, should be, one, safe, should feel safe, and secondly, that they should become part of the political process. And that's exactly what the upcoming elections on May 25th are supposed to provide. The first chance for all Ukrainians to participate and say what they think about, for example, who is to be president of the country.
Mm-hmm. And what about you and the people surrounding you in Odessa, in southern Ukraine? Do you all feel safe?
I do. And our region in Odessa here has been remarkably quiet. While we have also been witnessing the kind of turmoil that has occurred in Kiev and that, as a result of the change in government, is now continuing to manifest itself in other regions of the country. But Odessa is known for taking life easy, for being a cosmopolitan city, and for its humor. As a matter of fact, I heard a joke today about journalists. You know, there's a lot of Western journalists around asking people what they think and, you know, what's happening in your city. So a journalist asks an Odessan, well, tell me, do you have fascists here? Do you feel safe? And the answer is, you know, there's a lot of room for everybody in our synagogue. This is a very Jewish city. So, yeah, they're kind of, you know, taking it easy and if, as much as they can. But, of course, eventually the turmoil in the country, if it doesn't end, does hit everyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, you picked quite a time to be on sabbatical leave as a U.S. Fulbright research scholar. Not too much relaxation involved in this one, huh? Thank you very much, Professor, for being with us. And I guess we lost the connection, so that was perfect timing. Professor Nikolai Petro, professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island, and in Ukraine right now in Odessa on a Fulbright research scholarship. He was special assistant for policy in the U.S. State Department during the collapse of the Soviet Union. Joining us now is Evgeny Finkel, assistant professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University. He was born in the Soviet Union and raised in Israel and received his master's and PhD in political science from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is a native speaker of Russian, and he is fluent in Ukrainian. And Professor Finkel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah, our great pleasure. If you could describe the state of tension right now between the United States and Russia over all of these issues, would you agree that it is as tense as it ever was after the Cold War? Is it that bad or not?
No, I think it's a very correct estimation. I think it's probably the lowest point of Russian-American relations since the Cold War, and it's certainly much worse than 2008 Russian-Georgian War, which was considered until now to be the lowest point.
And why? Why is it so tense? Why are we so concerned about what's happening?
So there are several reasons. First, I think it's quite unpredictable what's going to happen next, and really, my impression is that very few people know what exactly Putin had in mind sending troops to Crimea, and we don't really know what is his end game is and what exactly he wants to achieve. Another reason is that Ukraine is simply a much more important, much more bigger country than Georgia. Ukraine, it's a second largest country in Europe after Russia when it comes to territory. It's a country of about 45 million people. It borders NATO, which is another cause of concern. And legally speaking, in 1994, U.S., U.K., and Russia gave Ukraine assurances for Ukraine's security and territorial integrity in exchange for Ukraine giving up the nuclear weapons. Ukraine wasn't a nuclear state after the collapse of the Soviet Union. It actually had the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world, and they did what the international community demanded. They gave up their nuclear weapons. They transferred them to Russia in exchange for a memorandum which was signed by the UK, US, and Russia, which guaranteed Ukrainian territorial integrity. So technically, this is the United States and the United UK's and the Russians' job to preserve the territorial integrity of Ukraine rather than sending troops in.
This also
can have huge impact on the nuclear proliferation agenda. I'm sure that people in Iran are now following very closely what's going on in Ukraine, and any idea that giving security guarantees in exchange for freezing a nuclear program would not go very far in negotiations with Iran, for example, after what we see in Ukraine right now.
Well, I didn't know the reason for that memorandum and why we signed it, so thank you for clarifying that. So this country, Ukraine, has been described as extremely poor. I read something today saying that the leadership is saying, well, we may not have weapons, we don't have much of a military, but we sure have spirit. So if anything bad were to come their way in terms of more involvement by Russian troops, they would have a hard time defending themselves. It's hard to defend yourself with spirit, isn't it?
Yes, it does. I mean, we should remember that the country is going bankrupt in a large part because most of the money on the state accounts was stolen by its leadership, and I heard various estimates. I think the highest one was about $70 billion stolen from the state by the elites. Yeah, so the country is bankrupt not because it doesn't have resources, but because it was very much and very effectively used by the elites for their personal enrichment. And this was one of the reasons that brought people to the street that that led to this change in power in Kyiv. So with spirit, you're right. There is not much you can do, but Ukraine actually has a standing military, a pretty large military of about 130,000 troops. It's not well equipped. Of course, it's not a match to the Russian one, but even with that, you can do a lot, especially given that Ukrainian guerrillas in the west, in the western part of the country, fought Red Army until early mid-1950s with no much more than a spirit. So there is an experience of fighting Russians for many years without having the resources to do so. It's in the blood and in the family history of many people, not in the south or east of the country where Professor Petro is right now, but in the western part of the country.
Yeah. So tell me, the people of Ukraine, tell me what the toppling of the government was all about. What were they most upset about? And is there a clear idea of where they would like to go now?
So the question about what led to the toppling of the government, it's a combination of reasons. First, many people were deeply disturbed by the president's policies and how he conducted its policies. The president was basically a thug with two separate criminal convictions for armed robbery, and for many people, and some investigations for rape that were closed. So he was not a nice guy. He was certainly not a Democrat. He was not the president that most people in any country would love to see leading their state. But so what brought people to the street is one part of it was the contempt for the president who comes from the Russian-speaking part of the country and who was becoming more and more heavily authoritarian and trying to imitate Putin in his dealings with the opposition. So the person who lost the second round of presidential elections ended up in jail for pretty much trumped-up accusations. He was becoming more and more authoritarian. He promised economic reforms, which never materialized. He, for years, promised move Ukraine closer to Europe, and suddenly when he was about to sign the association agreement and free trade agreement with the European Union, he turned back to Russia and said, sorry, no, I can't do it. So this brought people to the street. Then he quite stupidly tried to use heavy repression against protesters, and then that brought even more people to the street and ended up with a quite spontaneous, quite leaderless, in my view, toppling of the government. And this is for Putin, I think, was the worst case, worst imagined scenario, because in Russians' mind, Ukraine and Russia are quite similar. So if it could happen in Ukraine, then in Putin's mind, it was probably something to be very much worried about.
And what about in your mind? You speak Ukrainian, you speak Russian, you were born in Russia. Are there a great deal of similarities between the two countries, or are there substantial differences?
I was actually born in Ukraine.
Oh, you were? Oh.
Yes. This is why I speak Ukrainian. Usually people who are born in Russia do not speak Ukrainian.
Right, but you speak
And many people who are born in Ukraine as well do not speak Ukrainian as well. I mean, the main cleavage line in Ukraine is not ethnic. The main cleavage line is linguistic. There are many Ukrainians who speak Russian, and for them, Russian is their first language. There are many Russians who are pretty much bilingual. So in terms ethnically and religiously, Russians and Ukrainians are very similar. When we're speaking about central and eastern and southern parts of the country, they lived together for many years in the Soviet Union. They are both Christian Orthodox. The languages are very similar. The main difference is Ukrainians who live in the western part of the country, in the so-called Western Ukraine. They have a very different historical trajectory. They came under Russian rule only in 1939, so during World War II. Before that, they were in Poland and in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. They are not Orthodox, they are Greek Catholic, which means that they recognize the Pope in Rome as the head of their church. They, as I said earlier, fought against the Red Army for many years, so they are quite different from Russians. But Western Ukraine is not a majority of Ukraine. And in the other part of the country, in the rest of Ukraine, the Russians and Ukrainians are pretty similar, and neither Russians nor Ukrainians in Ukraine would want to become Russians in their citizenship or to move under Russian control, with the possible exception of Crimea, although earlier today, I saw the recent public opinion data, and even in Crimea, only 41% of people would want to join Russia, for the Ukraine to join Russia.
Oh, really? So why are they? You would think that they would have more confidence. They're calling this election or this referendum on March 16th.
Well, remember that when you have people with guns on the ground, what is more important is not how people vote, but who counts the vote and how votes are counted. And Russia has a pretty good experience in having rigged elections and knowing the results in advance.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. We have people on hold. Evgeny Finkel is our guest, assistant professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University, born in Ukraine, speaks Ukrainian, speaks Russian, raised in Israel, received his master's and PhD in political science from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he is our guest this part of the show. Here's our number. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, two phone calls. Adam is next in Presque Isle. Hi, Adam.
Hi, thank you very much for having this show. I have a question which is directed more at the general coverage of the situation there, and it deals with the Russian-Ukraine. I am a historian, to full disclosure, and I've worked a lot on ethnic minorities. I do not understand why people cannot embrace the idea of plebiscites like they had in southern Sudan or East Timor to give the eastern and southern Ukraine a chance for the first time to decide on their fate. First of all, it was Stalin who drew the current eastern boundaries of the Ukraine in the 1930s, and then Khrushchev decided to give away the Crimea in the 1950s. And in neither case did the people that were put into those different territories ever have a say over where they wanted to be. And I think the statistics show that, in fact, some statistics show that there are certain of the eastern provinces that are 70 to 90% ethnic Russian and Russian speakers, and certainly the Crimea is. And what's wrong with having a plebiscite with international observers, for example, and let people vote? The other question is just what does our speaker or anyone else think will happen in the elections that are coming up if all of the deputies in the new parliament from the East and South want either total autonomy, complete autonomy, or to join Russia? Mm-hmm. Now, are they going to throw them out of the new parliament? And I'll listen to the reply.
Thank you, Adam, for your call. Professor Finkel.
So when it comes to numbers, actually, it's important to differentiate between numbers of ethnic Russians and Russian speakers. So in terms of Russian speakers, you're right, the South and the East are overwhelmingly Russian-speaking, but that doesn't mean that they're ethnically Russian. Actually, the only region of Ukraine that has an ethnically Russian majority is Crimea, and even there it's about 58%. So most of the population, both in the east and in the south, are Ukrainians, and the idea that they would want to join Russia, well, I'm quite skeptical about that. About the idea of having referendums and plebiscites more generally, well, the question is where exactly you stop with that and all the other problems that it might create, including legal problems. For example, as I mentioned, the Budapest Memorandum that was signed by the U.S. and guaranteed the U.S. the Ukrainian international integrity. And I'm quite doubtful that most people in the East would want to join Russia. This is an idea that Russian government very much supports, and in my view also quite genuinely believes that people in the East want to join Russia. We have virtually zero evidence that this is precisely the case. So I cited the public opinion data from today. In Crimea, 41% want to join Russia. In Donetsk, which is the stronghold of pro-Russian, of the post-president Yanukovych, which is overwhelmingly Russian-speaking, and the second largest concentration of ethnic Russians in Ukraine, if I remember correctly, only one-third of people want to join Russia. So we have pretty much zero evidence that people in East Ukraine want to join Russia. I think that what the current situation does and the Putin sending troops to Crimea consolidates the nation very much against Russia. So he might get Crimea as his short-term gain, but as a long-term gain, I think we now see a more unified Ukrainian identity than it ever was since the independence.
And if that percentage is 41, unless you stuff the ballots, and maybe that would happen, there could be a decision made to not join Russia on March 16th.
That's a possibility. Again, the numbers, it's pretty hard to know the exact numbers during political crisis when people with guns are on the ground. So I'm not sure how precise these numbers are, but it's pretty clear that the major cities in Crimea are very much pro-Russian because of their population. They're mostly ethnic Russians, many Red Soviet Army veterans. They do want to join Russia. When we move to the countryside, the situation is much, much more complicated. We should not forget that it's not only Russians who live there. It's also a pretty substantial Crimean Tatar population who are very much anti-Russian and do not want to join Russia. Ukrainians in Crimea, it's also quite questionable how they would vote. I think it's too early to say how this referendum would and might end up, again, unless you stop the ballots and know the results in advance.
Let's just spend a moment on the Tatar population. They were, I read, expelled by Stalin, and they've been moving back, would you say, in large numbers to the Ukraine?
They were allowed to move back in 1980s, 1988, if I remember correctly. Currently, they're about 12% of the population of Crimea, which is about 300,000 out of total population of 700,000 Crimean Tatars. So about 40% of the Crimean Tatars did move back to Crimea, and they're quite a powerful and active political and social force in Crimea that we should also take into account when we speak about the region.
Joel is next in Appleton. Hi, Joel.
Hi, I got two comments. One, part of Europe's problem as far as leverage goes is that they choose to get roughly a quarter of their energy from Russia. And if you're going to be so intermeshed with, a dictator or an undemocratic country like Russia, you're bound to get into trouble. The second comment I want to make is I find to some degree Western Europe to be a little hypocritical when they talk about the corruption in Ukraine, because it couldn't have been as vast as it was without the assistance of German, Swiss, and English banks.
Professor.
Well, I completely agree with you on both accounts. Europe very much depends on the Russian gas, and this is one of the main reasons why we don't see a unified, forceful European reactions to what is going on in Crimea. We see Central and Eastern European states, the former communist states, are much more bellicose and much more vocal in their opposition compared to the old members like Germany, France, Italy, and others, precisely because there is so much dependence on the Russian gas. But I think the situation now has a sobering effect on Western Europe, and in the coming years, we will see Europe trying to move as far as possible from the energy dependence on Russia. On the second point, I completely agree with you, although we do see some change in this attitude. So several European countries decided to freeze the bank accounts and assets of Ukrainian oligarchs and politicians who are responsible for human rights violation in Ukraine. When we speak about possible ways to deal with Russia right now, I mean, of course, military option is off the table, but targeted economic sanctions against the elites are on the table, and this is what people are talking about. And of course, this will require U.S. and European united front and cooperation on this account. So you're right. Economically, of course, European Union plays a huge economic interest of EU play a huge role, and they also have their fair share of responsibility for what happened.
And you are pretty confident that military options are off the table for us?
I also was confident that Russia would never invade Ukraine, so as far as predictions go, I have a pretty poor record, but I don't think that we will see any military European or American response to what is going on in Ukraine unless there will be some dramatic change. As things stand now, no, I don't believe that there is any serious consideration to send troops to Ukraine, and I think that there is no need to do it from any perspective.
Mm-hmm. And what about the establishment of a new government in Ukraine? In order for things, for people to be happy, you have to have something to, a government you feel is doing good for you. Is that a process that's underway right now, the creation of a strong government?
Well, strong government is probably too strong a word to use right now. Right now, the state is in a mild chaos, so there is no violence, and when it comes to public safety, it looks pretty decent. But again, the ability of the government to pay pensions or to pay salaries to people is quite limited because the state are bankrupt. There is an interim government, and in the current situation, they do what they can. And given the constraints they're dealing with, they do a pretty good job right now. There will be a more permanent and more legitimate government after the elections in May, but it will take many years to rebuild state capacity to the level that we can describe it as a strong government or a strong state. But again, given the constraints and given the condition of the current government, does what it can, it does it pretty well.
Yeah. It'll need some help, I imagine. Thank you so much, Professor Finkel, for being with us and speaking to Wisconsin again.
My pleasure.
Professor Evgeny Finkel, Assistant Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at George Washington University, studied at Madison, got his PhD and MA there, and was born in Ukraine. We thank him for being with us. Thanks for your calls and interest in this subject. Thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production and for producing this interesting program. We have news coming up momentarily, and then we'll return. We'll find out what happened before this Wisconsin Senate Committee on the creation of a new standards board. There were 110 superintendents from all over Wisconsin who attended the hearing in opposition to the new state academic standards committee. Why was there a call for that? We'll talk about all of it next hour.
Freddie Mercury, frontman for the band Queen, was recognized around the world for his powerful rock and roll.